Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Erwin Chemerinsky, and I represent the defendant, appellant Vivian Tatt. Ms. Landau and I will divide the 20 minutes equally, and I'd like to reserve two of my 10 minutes for rebuttal. Late on a Friday afternoon, a judge who repeatedly expressed that the trial had been concluded on Friday intruded himself into the jury deliberation process in a manner that was inappropriate, unconstitutional. This tainted the verdict and requires its reversal. I want to focus on the two jury notes and how the judge handled them. I want to start with note two. The judge here answered the jury's note without consulting with the lawyers, as the Constitution requires, and in a manner that decided a key question that was left to the jury. A crucial issue was the failure of Raymond Tan to testify. This was the focus of defense counsel in closing argument. The jury asked, where is Raymond Tan? The Supreme Court has said for over a century, when a jury asks a question, the judge is obligated to consult with counsel before formulating a response. This court has said, in United States versus Martinez, that the failure to consult adequately is itself reversible error. Here, the judge simply did not consult. There's actually...
May I ask you about that? Because, I mean, we're in sort of an unusual situation in that there's some dispute about what actually took place at the trial. But if we, for a moment, if we accept Mr. Schaffler's defense counsel's declaration of what happened, it says that the judge said he was going to tell the jury, that Tan's absence from trial was not an issue for their determination. And then it says, that he proceeded to do that. But based on that declaration, Tan's counsel was present when the judge said he was going to do that. So why could they not at that point have said, Your Honor, we object, please don't do that? Why wasn't that an adequate opportunity for an objection?
Well, at that point, the defense counsel certainly expressed disagreement with what the judge was doing. The problem was there was no hearing. Judge Miller, contrast what the judge did with note two compared to note one. When note one came in, the judge called all the parties in, brought in the court reporter, and allowed for an objection on the record. Here, the judge simply told the lawyers what they were doing. And here, Your Honor, I think you have to focus on what the Supreme Court said in United States versus Rogers and the obligation to consult with counsel. There's no dispute here. No consultation occurred. In fact, the government itself said, and here if you look at volume 2, ER page 163, that it was not present when this occurred, nor was the attorney for Schaub present when this occurred. This court has said there must be sufficient consultation.
Well, that's where the dispute comes in, because the judge said that both counsel were present, and counsel for Zhao didn't, as I recall it at least, independently put in a declaration saying that they were not present. This came from a third party, essentially. So it seems to me that unless we're going to say that the judge wasn't telling the truth, which is, it's possible, but it's a kind of a tough call for us to make, we're left with your argument that when a judge says, well, this is what I'm going to do, and I really, that doesn't count. And, judges have different styles, and sometimes they're impatient, and sometimes, it requires defense counsel to be a little more assertive. But if all counsel were present, is it your argument that simply saying, here's the answer I want to give, is insufficient as a matter of law?
No, Your Honor, if there is the opportunity, quote, to be heard before the judge responds, that's the language from Rogers versus United States.
And if counsel were there, then they had an opportunity to holler because I don't think there's an allegation that the answer had already been sent to the jury before the judge made that comment.
But counsel wasn't there. I want to direct you to the page, and it's This is the quote from the government on page 163. As it relates to the defendant's argument regarding jury note 2, the government relies entirely on defendant's recitation of events, as the government was not present in the defendant's interaction with the court. Also, there is the requirement for consulting. But even if you accept all of that, Your Honor.
So wait a minute. Let's suppose then that all the defense counsel were there and the government counsel wasn't, and the defense counsel said, oh, you know, we want to talk about this note. This is exactly what we wanted to say. And the judge says, that's fantastic. I'll use your version. Is it your position that because the government lawyer wasn't there, you would win on appeal there too?
No, Your Honor. In that situation, it's different. But there is the obligation to consult. But even if I accept that procedurally there was no problem, substantively the judge decided the issue that should have been for the jury. This is the other problem here. And here, Your Honor, the language from this court in United States versus Ramirez, 714 F3rd at 1138, is exactly on point. This court said, by instructing the jurors to disregard any uncertainty why the prosecutor did not call a witness who might have been the key witness, the court improperly intruded itself into the jury room and interfered with the jury's role as a fact finder. That's exactly what occurred in this instance. So either on the procedural level or on the substantive level, the judge acted improperly.
Well, counsel, I have one other question. Jury instruction number 20 said, for reasons that do not concern you, the case against your client is no longer before you. Do not speculate why. So isn't it really just a restatement of jury instruction 20?
Your Honor, I think it is. Once the matter has gone to the jury should be looking at the entire record, not for the judge to tell the jury that this to disregard their question.
But it didn't say disregard. That is not an issue for your determination, which is what jury instruction 20 says. That case is no longer before you.
But, Your Honor, United States versus Ramirez is exactly this situation. And there this court found that it to be reversible error. And that's why I think that this court here would say, and should say, that the judge improperly intruded into the jury selection process. And, of course, there's also here the problem with regard to jury note number one, where the judge, again, rather than telling the jury, look at the entire record, directs the jury to a particular set of exhibits and implicitly accepts the prosecution's argument that fraud occurred. And what this shares in common with my answer to your question, Judge Graber, is in both instances, the judge should have said to the jury, look at the record, not answered the question for the jury in this way. And with your permission, I'll save my remaining 2 minutes for rebuttal.
You may do that. We'll hear from Ms. Landau.
May it please the court, I'm Karen Landau and I represent Ruman Zhao. I'm going to address the question of the prosecutor's misconduct in this case. So in this case, in closing rebuttal, the last thing that the jury heard before they started deliberations, the prosecutor committed misconduct by arguing that by stating baldly that they didn't call the cooperator, Raymond Tan, because he wasn't truthful with the government, and the government wasn't allowed to call untruthful witnesses. By doing so, the government vouched. The government committed a variety of offenses. The government prosecutor made herself a witness to credibility. The government also vouched by implication for the credibility of the government's other witnesses, because obviously if the government didn't call a witness they believed to be untruthful, then the witnesses they did call were by definition truthful.
Counsel, let me ask you a couple of questions. The first,
certainly,
to do with our standard of review. There was no objection, as I understand it, so we review for plain error. Is that, do you agree?
I don't agree entirely, Your Honor. I think that it's the colloquy between the court and the prosecutor where the judge invited the prosecutor to commit misconduct would make review for harmless error appropriate. Now, I suppose that in the face of a court exhorting the prosecutor to defend yourself, you've been attacked, go ahead, a brave defense counsel might nonetheless have objected, but I think that that takes this case out of the normal.
This has to do with, in a way, the question that I asked your colleague. There are judges that are more aggressive on the bench and more difficult to deal with. We all know that as a fact of life. And isn't it still the obligation of defense counsel to make an objection on pain of being reviewed for plain error?
Your Honor, I do think that the colloquy here is more than an impatient judge. The judge expressed his opinion on how this should be addressed.
And that's not my question, though. You're saying if the judge makes a really, really, really bad mistake, then we don't review for plain error, even though there's no objection?
Well, I guess my answer is still no at this point, no. I think at some point you have to say we can't apply a plain error. But I will say that I think reversal is required, at least from my client, even if it is reviewed for plain error. And I'd be happy to address that in further detail. I realize I'm not answering your question with an absolute yes or no, but I do think there are certain circumstances that should take a case out of Rule 52. And this
there are cases, too, that perhaps take it out of the realm of misconduct. That it's clear that the prosecutor was not sure what to do. And when you're not sure what to do, you ask the judge in camera, what should I do? And the judge told them what to do, and they did what the judge said. The concept of invited error hasn't been raised in those terms, but I think in a sense, wasn't that what the judge was saying? You've been basically invited to do this by the defense arguments.
And that I would disagree with, and I think the record absolutely demonstrates that's not correct. That this is not an invited error situation where you might give the prosecutor some leniency. I think, here's the thing. The government was free not to call Raymond Tan. And as the government argued, they didn't feel they could call him because they believed he was untruthful. But they had conflicting statements in his proffers. So that, the government had to leave the record the way it was. I mean, the government didn't call him, and the defense was free to make an argument based on, in good faith, on what the proffer statements said, which the proffer statements supported an inference that Raymond Tan lied to his wife and to Vivian Tat, and then there were some other statements in the proffers that had to do that undermined the government's argument.
He did change his story over time, yes, to try to protect his wife, or at least that's the way one could interpret it. That he moved from implicating her as fully guilty to saying, "Well, no, it was my fault."
Well, that's correct, Your Honor, but here's the thing. He said what he said. The government thought he was lying, and maybe he was, and maybe he wasn't. We don't know. But that proffer is enough for the defense to argue, to say, the government chose not to call him. He's a cooperator.
Well, you also chose not to call him. Correct?
No, they tried, actually. And if there's emails to that effect, they tried, and they were told that he would assert the Fifth Amendment. So that's...
Is that sufficient if you don't call the person and have them invoke it to make them unavailable?
Your Honor, I can't answer that question. I would think so. The court did not believe it was, but I would think it is. And certainly...
Do you have any authority for that?
I do not.
That a witness is unavailable simply because they tell you that and you don't actually have to call them and test it?
I don't think, counsel, you can put your client on the stand only to invoke the Fifth. I think that flies in the face of a bunch of things.
But, well, that's correct.
Was
your
not your client.
He was not my client. I was going to make that point. This is the cooperator. He was not my client.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
It's fine. So the prosecutor, I think back to the question of invited error, there was certainly enough for defense counsel to say the government, it's a reasonable inference to say the government didn't call him because he didn't know, want you to know. The government didn't call this witness because the government didn't want you to hear his testimony. That was reasonable. Once that happened, the prosecutor doesn't get to respond. That's the choice they have to make. They chose not to call him. They don't get to say...
But you left the inference that this was a deliberate act by the prosecution to hide a witness that was favorable to you.
I think that inference is fair from the record.
That is not what the record demonstrates. Or at least there is an equally plausible or more plausible explanation. And I think that was the box that the judge was responding to.
You know, Your Honor, I would have to say I disagree with that. I think that in this situation, the government has to remain silent and take it, you know, they present their case, they have the burden. It's, you know, they made their choice. They could have called Raymond Tan and let him face cross-examination. The government chose not to do that. That's fine as far as it goes. But the question is, you know, the defense counsel gets to make reasonable, an argument based on reasonable inferences. And in this case, you know, there was evidence that the government, you know, there was, he was, I mean, this was a percipient witness. He was all over the place. And they didn't call him. Your Honor, if there's no more questions, I would save my last minute and a half for rebuttal.
You may do that.
Thank you.
And we'll hear next from Mr. Alden.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Bram Alden for the United States. I'm going to start where Mr. Chemerinsky left off, which is with this issue of the second jury note. And first, I want to correct the factual record, because as both Judges Miller and Graber have now observed, the district court made comments rejecting the defendant's claims below that they were not present and had no opportunity to object, and instead said, "We were all here, and the response was not etched in stone when people came back into the courtroom." What I would correct then beyond that is that the prosecutor never adopted the defense's assessment or explanation of what happened. In fact, if you look at GER 85, which was a transcript from the hearing on Defendant Tat's motion for bail pending appeal, the prosecutor made very clear what the government's account of the facts was, which was that the defendants and their counsel arrived first, but the prosecutor arrived when the court still had not sent the note back to the jury with an answer, and the court told the government its, quote, proposed response, which the government endorsed as, quote, proper. So even by the time the government arrived, there had been no response to the jury note as a factual matter.
Do you know anything about why this wasn't on the record? I mean, is that a common practice in that district in your experience? I mean, because the other conference, note one was on the record, right?
Note one was not discussed on the record. Note one was discussed off the record, after which counsel for Defendant Tat went on the record to make an objection. And that actually is the same that happened with the jury instructions. That conference took place in camera in the judge's chambers, after which Defendant Tat's counsel went on the record to make an objection. So it is this district judge's practice. It is unorthodox in the district, but it is certainly commonplace in his courtroom. And if the defendants had wanted to challenge that practice on appeal, this would have been a very different appeal. So once you set aside that factual analysis, you then get to plain error review, because there was actually no objection made on the record of the substantive analysis. And I think Judge Graber really hit the nail on the head here, which is that jury instruction 20 was precisely designed to prevent the jury from speculating as to why the case of a co-defendant was not before the jury. And that jury instruction is itself derived from this court's model instruction 1.15. At the time of this trial, it was 1.16, but the parties submitted it on the theory that the jury should not be considering whether a co-defendant was punished or is in custody or even was prosecuted. And so,
maybe you're right. They shouldn't be considering that. But if the question is, and maybe that's what the note meant, but if we read the note as being about, why didn't we hear from him? Why wasn't he called to testify? That seems pretty close to what we addressed in Ramirez, doesn't it?
I would say first, Your Honor, that the note can't be just construed in the defense's favor, particularly on plain error review. And given the ambiguity, that sets this case apart from Ramirez, where in that case, the judge gave a sua sponte instruction that directly prohibited the missing witness inference. And so this court held that that sua sponte instruction, which of course the defense would not have had an opportunity to object to because it was sua sponte, was erroneous because it precluded the adverse inference, the adverse missing witness inference. Now, I would make two comments in response to if we construe the note in that fashion. I think we would still prevail here because the government would still prevail here for two reasons. One, the response was not prejudicial, just as in Ramirez itself. So if we're going to rely on Ramirez, you should also follow the prejudice analysis, which held that there was no other reasonable explanation for what the defendant did in that case. The same is true here. The second is that in Ramirez, that put the inference off limits, whereas here, the defense had already made that comment in closing argument, and when the government objected, the objection was actually overruled. So the inference was put before the jury, even during closing argument.
That takes us to the other issue about that was argued so far, which has to do with the very odd way that the final argument went. And it certainly is, in ordinary circumstances, without the judges having said, go do this, it would be improper argument, would it not?
Yes. And we concede that, Your Honor. I wrote that in the brief because I completely agree that had the judge not exhorted the prosecutor to do exactly this, that it would have been clear or obvious error on the part of the prosecutor, at which point we would move into the third and fourth prongs of plain error.
Well, then why, if we're going to say that defense counsel have an obligation to stand up to an assertive judge, by making objections, even when it seems intimidating or futile, why isn't it the obligation of a prosecutor to stand up to this same judge and say, well, upon reflection, it isn't right?
There certainly is no law in a comparable context that would be analogous to preserving an objection to avoid plain error review versus a prosecutor saying, this judge is incorrect, particularly given that the prosecutor proposed this. So I acknowledge that fact pattern led to this. But what happens then, there's no case law saying that a prosecutor commits plain misconduct by defying, by following it rather than defying the judge's clear directive. And so that's why I think this does take this out of the realm of cases in which you could find that there was plain misconduct. Moving on, though, to the third and fourth prongs, if this was error, it was harmless. And I think the harmlessness analysis is really important in this case because it should control all of the issues, even if there was any error with respect to any issue. The core of this case was a transaction that reeked of illegitimacy. Five people...
parts of it were on tape and so on, so people saw it. But I want to turn, if I may, to something that hasn't been argued yet that has to do with the merits of the evidentiary sufficiency on count three. I have some difficulty, and speaking only for myself, of course, with understanding how count three survives, because the entry that was made with respect to the cashier's check accurately reflected what happened. Cash in and cashier's check out. There was no place to put on that document, as I understand it, why it was happening or anything like that. So, you know, there are plenty of crimes that flow from this activity, but I have difficulty seeing that there's evidence that defendant Tat intended that entry by itself to injure or deceive the bank. It couldn't have injured or deceived the bank, which is a required element of 1005. So I'd like you to respond to that and tell me why there's sufficient evidence.
Yes, Your Honor. I completely agree that on its face, the form was accurate. The reason that this can still be prosecuted as a false entry count is because the case law dating back to Darby by the Supreme Court, but even more on point, this court's decision in Hargreaves holds that when you conduct a straw transaction with a straw purchaser, you create, by definition, records that are false, even if they correctly document the truth.
Except those arose in a very different context than a cashier's check. And so the financial reality of a cashier's check, I think, must play into the analysis. Those other cases that you refer to don't involve that. They involve things such as a loan, where it does matter to the bank whose finances back something and so forth. So are you aware of any case involving a cashier's check in which a facially correct entry, which does not affect the bank's fisc in any way, is held to violate Section 1005?
Yes, Your Honor. Hargreaves did indeed. If you look closely at that case, it talks about cashier's checks in particular and talks about obtaining cash. And there is a part I had written in my notes, page 72, but that may be off. But there is definitely a discussion in Hargreaves about the use of what they call dummy signatories to obtain both cash and cashier's checks from the bank. And the court went on in Hargreaves to say, the entries in question found their way to the books and reports because the defendant set the machinery in motion which required the entries to be made, and that alone was the false entry theory that supported the convictions in that case.
Except in that case, the entries did not reflect the true relationship between the bank and the officers of the bank, among other things, and that isn't the case here.
I do think, though, that the Hargreaves decision talks about dummy signatories. I don't know if it uses the word straw man buyer, but that was answering the question that Darby left open,
that would implicate perhaps other crimes, perhaps a conspiracy, but I'm unsure what else the defendant, Ms. Tat, could have done. I mean, the form was the form, she filled it out, and that was that. Whatever, you know, her intent was, I think is a stretch here.
I would totally agree, but for the fact that I do think this question was decided in Hargreaves. And frankly, Your Honor, if we were charging this again today, we might have charged it as a different count. The question merely, though, for the court is, looking at the binding precedents, regardless of their age, is it the case that the government can prosecute a false entry count based on a straw man buyer transaction, which is exactly what this was? And in Darby, the Supreme Court analogized that case to perhaps a case in which the bank received dollars that were known to be counterfeit and then deposited them and created records.
Well, let's think of a completely different scenario. Let's suppose that I have an account balance of $10,000 and I go in and I ask for a cashier's check for $1,000. I actually have the money. It goes to them. They give me now, does it matter that I intend to give that to a drug dealer? Does it matter that I acquired that money through defrauding my next door neighbor? I don't see how that is a violation of 1005, but that seems to be your theory. If either the proceeds somehow were ill-gotten or the recipient of that cashier's check is somebody who ought not have it. But that doesn't seem to meet the requirement of the statute for an intent to defraud the bank.
I would certainly not take the position that those hypotheticals meet the standard.
How are they different than this?
In this case, the transaction itself was designed to result in entries that would not depict the true condition of what had happened.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I understand that with respect to count two, but the entries for count three, by their nature, I mean, it just says, you know, the date that there was a check and the amount. The count three entry didn't say who it was going to or who it was coming from. So how could that entry have depicted the true nature of the transaction? It doesn't seem like that was what it was designed to do.
So a true transaction report would have indicated that the cash came from Yip, and it would not have listed Fang's bank account number. And in count two, it would not have listed Zhao's name, but it was Fang's bank account number because the defendants designed a scheme that would result in a bank record that did not reflect who brought the money into the room that day. And that's why I think, to respond to Judge Hillman's question of what could Tat have done differently, the answer is, I'm sorry, are all judges still there?
Yes, we are. You're frozen too, yes. But we can hear you.
Okay, well, I'll carry on. I think the answer to Judge Hillman's question then is that what Tat should have done differently is not arranged and engineered a transaction that would result in bank records reflecting first a cashier's check that had to be refunded to Fang, the account holder, but instead money that went through the bank because it came from Yip. And secondly, a cashier's check that was purchased with money that came from Yip, not defendant Zhao through her own bank accounts.
Sounds like a conspiracy description to me, counsel.
And it
was a conspiracy.
Excuse me, I thought it was undisputed that there was no place in the entry or the form for that entry where you could even list, who it was for or who supplied the funds. But it seems to me that when there is an account with sufficient funds in it and a cashier's check is drawn on that by the person whose funds are listed, I don't understand how that's a violation of this particular statute. There are so many other things. It could be a criminal act, but that wasn't what was charged.
I think that it was multiple crimes. It was absolutely a conspiracy, and it was a criminal act under multiple statutes.
Yes, but count three doesn't say that. Count three is under 1005 only, as I understand it. Am I wrong about that?
That's correct.
Okay.
That is correct, Your Honor. Nonetheless, count three was charged because the report revealed what had happened, but that what had happened was manufactured and engineered to create a bank record that wouldn't reveal the true nature of the transaction. And I really do think that that dates all the way back to Darby, because if, as the Supreme Court pointed out in Darby, the deposit of counterfeit money that was then entered into the books as cash could be prosecuted as a false entry.
Except this case involves actual non-counterfeit money in an actual account that was sufficient to cover the amount of the cashier's check, and the amount was correctly and accurately reported on Exhibit 48. So there is no literal falsehood. And there's also, I don't understand, well, I've made my concern clear, I think, that I don't understand how it falls even within Hargreaves and the other cases.
And Your Honor, I think I have also made my best argument on that score. And so I would urge the court, though, that especially with respect to the first two counts, this court should affirm. If the court needs to, it should affirm based on harmless error review. this was clearly a patently illegitimate transaction. I take the court's points about count three and have made the argument that I can. So unless the court has further questions, I'm willing to submit.
I don't see any movement
thank
by
you
my
very
colleagues,
much.
So I think not.
Thank you.
And we'll do the rebuttal in the same order as the original argument, starting with Mr. Chemerinsky.
Thank you. I want to focus a note to the judge, Eric, both procedurally and substantively. As to the procedural error, I want to make 2 points. First, there was not adequate consultation. This court in Martinez said that it's reversible error, quote, not only the court fails to consult about a jury note when it does so inadequately. There's no factual dispute that there was not adequate consultation. In fact, in terms of the government's own position, again, if you look at page 163 of volume 2 of the excerpt of record, it says, it arrived in the courtroom, quote, to learn of the court's response to jury note number 2. Second, there was an objection at the earliest possible time. The defense had repeatedly asked for a missing witness instruction. It made clear when the judge was going to do this that it disagreed. The first time that the defense had the opportunity to file an objection was in the motion for a new trial, and that's when it did so. Substantively, the judge erred. In your honors, the Ramirez case is exactly on point. To go back to Judge Graber's question about jury note instruction 20, it basically says, don't find the defendant guilty based on whatever happened to the co-defendants. The defense focused in closing argument on the importance of Raymond Tan's absence. The defense said that a negative inference should be drawn from Raymond Tan's absence. What the jury basically did was be told by the judge to completely disregard that. And it's on that basis, either from a procedural perspective or from a substantive perspective, the judge erred. And I'd also focus on the response to jury note number 1, where the judge erred by, instead of telling the jury to look at the entire record, pointed the jury to specific exhibits. In doing so, the judge implicitly conveyed the message that he agreed with the prosecution that fraud had occurred and he acted inappropriately. The D.C. Circuit case, United States versus Miller, is exactly on point here. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Ms. Landau?
Yes, Your Honor. Just a couple of points. First, I want to address the question of harmless or plain error, at least with respect to Ruman Zhao. I think the court, the only question for Ms. Zhao, since she was at the transaction, was her intent. And the I would argue the evidence against her was just not overwhelming as to her intent. Yes, the transaction didn't look good, but this is someone who was an unsophisticated person. She was a waitress her entire life. And she just, you know, the evidence against her was far from overwhelming. She made statements that could be inculpatory, but there was also evidence that they were made innocently because she was trying to provide comfort to the account holder who appeared uncomfortable. Lastly, I'd point out that the jury deliberated for 8 hours in what was a very, very simple case. That also militates against a finding of either harmless or in favor of a finding of plain error. The final thing I wanted to address is, and I may have misinterpreted your remarks, Judge Graber, but it seemed to me you were saying that the prosecutor couldn't have committed misconduct because the judge approved of the misconduct. And I think that if that's the ruling, that ruling basically even eliminates plain error. In other words, you'd be taking what is a forfeited error, arguably, or what is maybe should be reviewed for harmless error anyway, into the realm of waiver. At the minimum, this case has to be reviewed for plain error. And the prosecutor's misconduct was plain, regardless whether it was approved or not. And if there's no further, Your Honor, did you have a question?
No, I wish it sounded like you were winding up. That's
fine. I was going to say, if there's no further questions, I will submit. Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate excellent arguments from all three of you. They've been very helpful. And the case just argued is submitted.